Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, April 19th, 2021. Closing arguments in the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd. Prosecutors saying that Chauvin had to know Floyd's life was in danger when he put his knee on his neck for nearly 10 minutes, depriving him of oxygen. And jurors should trust their eyes, what they saw on the video, and their gut about what it means. Defense pointing out that Floyd's earlier resistance to attempts to arrest him and put him in a police car, arguing Chauvin's use of force was appropriate and justified, and also Floyd's drug use and heart problem contributed to the death. President Joe Biden said he is prepared to compromise on his more than $2 trillion jobs and infrastructure package. He made those remarks at the start of a meeting with a bipartisan group of lawmakers, all of whom previously served as mayors or governors. Today's the day that every adult 16 and older in the U.S. now eligible to get a COVID-19 vaccine. And the White House insists the president's goal of increasing the annual cap on refugee admissions to 62,500 was always aspirational, but he remains committed to getting the number above 15,000, which was set by former President Donald Trump. Story at the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Jurors heard competing arguments Monday about Derek Chauvin's guilt or innocence in the death of George Floyd late last spring, with the prosecution contending that there was no justification for the now-fired Minneapolis police officer's actions against Floyd, while the defense attorney countered that his client acted reasonably and based on his training. Before the arguments began, the judge, Peter Cahill, read the jury instructions to the jury, and they included elements required to convict Chauvin on each of the three charges against him: second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. Judge Cahill also said that without finding of excessive use of force, there is no crime.
No crime is committed if a police officer's actions were justified by the police officer's use of reasonable force in the line of duty in effecting a lawful arrest or preventing an escape from custody. The kind and degree of force a police officer may lawfully use in executing his duties is limited by what a reasonable police officer in the same situation would believe to be necessary. Any use of force beyond that is not reasonable. To determine if the actions of the police officer were reasonable, you must look at those facts which a reasonable officer in the same situation would have known at the precise moment the officer acted with force. You must decide whether the officer's actions were objectively reasonable in light of the totality of the facts and circumstances confronting the officer, and without regard to the officer's own subjective state of mind, intentions, or motivations. The defendant is not guilty of a crime if he used force as authorized by law. To prove guilt, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant's use of force was not authorized by law.
Judge Peter Cahill, Minnesota 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, part of the instructions to the jury. Now to some of the closing arguments from the lawyers, which lasted several hours on each side. Prosecutor Steve Schleicher arguing that Derek Chauvin's pinning of George Floyd to the pavement with a knee on his neck for that 9.5 minutes deprived him of oxygen until he died. And that is proof beyond reasonable doubt that this was a felony level of assault.
At that time, in that place, what George Floyd needed was some oxygen. That's what he needed. He needed to breathe, because people need that. Humans need that, to breathe. And he said that, and the defendant heard him say that over and over. He heard him, but he just didn't listen. He continued to push him down, to grind into him, to shimmy, to twist his hand for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. He begged, George Floyd begged until he could speak no more, and the defendant continued this assault. When he was unable to speak, the defendant continued. When he was unable to breathe, the defendant continued beyond the point that he had a pulse, beyond the point that he had a pulse. The defendant continued this assault 9 minutes and 29 seconds. When the ambulance arrived, the ambulance was here, and the defendant continued. He stayed on top of him. He would not get up. He would not let up. He stayed on him, grinding into him, continuing to twist his fingers, to hold him down. He had no pulse. He was not breathing. He was not responsive, and the defendant had to know what was right beneath him. Right beneath him. You saw the video. You saw the point when the ambulance arrived, and finally, after a paramedic got out, and the defendant still did not get up, and the paramedic tapped him, and finally, the defendant got up, and they lifted Mr. Floyd onto that gurney, and you saw the way he was not, there was nothing there. His head had to be held to prevent it from falling to the ground. He was completely limp. The defendant had to know that. He was there. He was on top of him. And he was on top of him. On top of him. Sometimes you ask for the truth, sometimes you insist on the truth. And the truth is the defendant was on top of him for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And he had to know. He had to know. The medical examiner would find the cause of George Floyd's death to be cardiopulmonary arrest, complicating law enforcement subdual restraint and neck compression. Well, what you saw the defendant and the other officers doing to George Floyd caused his death. The medical examiner ruled the death a homicide, death at the hands of another. What the defendant did to George Floyd killed him.
Steve Schlesher is Minnesota's Special Assistant Attorney General, part of the closing argument today. He again pointed to the bystander video footage, telling the juries, you can believe your eyes, it's what you felt in your gut, it's what you felt in your heart. He also, during this argument, said that jurors need not consider whether George Floyd was guilty or innocent of the original reason the police were called, the alleged use of a counterfeit $20 bill, or Floyd's alleged drug use.
Also need to be clear, this is not the trial of George Floyd. George Floyd is not on trial here. You've heard some things about George Floyd, that he struggled with drug addiction, that he was being investigated for allegedly passing a fake $20 bill, that there was never any evidence introduced that he knew was fake in the first place. Right? But he is not on trial. He didn't get a trial when he was alive. And he is not on trial here.
After the prosecution finished, the defense attorney for Derek Chauvin, Eric Nelson, had his turn. He told the jurors that this case is more than the 9 minutes and 29 seconds of the now infamous video of Chauvin's knee on George Floyd, that the jurors need to evaluate the totality of the circumstances that Chauvin faced and the decisions he made, and that when they do, they'll find that he acted according to his training. Nelson, for instance, pointing to how Chauvin treated Floyd when Floyd, under arrest and in handcuffs, resisted being placed in the back of a squad car.
Officer Chauvin made a decision not to use higher levels of force when he would have been authorized to do that, including punches, kicks, elbows, right? All of these tools were available to Officer Chauvin. That is not an intent to purposefully use unlawful force. They call for EMS within 1 minute of putting him on the ground. They step it up within another minute and a half. He believes that his, Officer Chauvin believes that Mr. Floyd's ability to speak means he can breathe, and they say it repeatedly, remember?
Oh.
Oh. Excuse me. They tell him to relax.
Oh my God.
Officer Chauvin is never swearing at him. He's not calling him names. all of this stuff that we've already talked about, and I don't need to go through this again, all of this stuff that we've talked about throughout the entirety of this circumstance does not reflect an intent to purposefully, intentionally commit an unlawful use of force. All of the evidence shows that Mr. Chauvin thought he was following his training. He was, in fact, following his training. He was following Minneapolis Police Department policies. He was trained this way. It all demonstrates a lack of intent. There is absolutely no evidence that Officer Chauvin intentionally, purposefully applied unlawful force.
Defense attorney Eric Nelson. He also argued that Chauvin's restraint tactics during the arrest were appropriate, that Nelson also focused on Floyd's drug use and underlying health conditions as factors that contributed to the death.
We have to analyze this case from the perspective of a reasonable police officer at the precise moment with the totality of the circumstances when it comes to the use of force. We have to look at the cause of death to determine, did Mr. Floyd die exclusively of asphyxia, or were there other contributing factors that were not the natural result of Mr. Chauvin's acts? Right? Things that happened that were set in motion before Mr. Chauvin ever arrived. The drug ingestion, right? The bad heart, the diseased heart, the hypertension. All of these things existed before Mr. Chauvin arrived. The struggle, what role did the struggle play? We know, based on a prior incident, that Mr. Floyd's heart was beating at 219 over 160 in a situation where he was confronted by police and had ingested drugs. He didn't die that day. All of this, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, all of this, when you take into consideration the presumption of innocence, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, I would submit to you that it is nonsense to suggest that none of these other factors had any role. That is not reasonable. And when you, as members of the jury, conclude your analysis of the evidence, when you review the entirety of the evidence, when you review the law as written, and you conclude it all within a thorough, honest analysis, the state has failed to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, Mr. Chauvin should be found not guilty of all counts.
Eric Nelson, attorney for Derek Chauvin. C-SPAN has been covering this trial and replaying the proceedings 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern the same day. You can watch them on C-SPAN 2 television. More from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Deliberations for this case are being done at an undisclosed location, presumably not in the Hennepin County Government Center, and that the jurors will remain sequestered throughout their deliberations and until the verdicts are read in a court before a worldwide live stream audience. In anticipation of those verdicts, especially if there are any not guilty, Minneapolis and many other large cities across the country preparing for possible large-scale street protest. Perhaps similar to the protest led by Black Lives Matter and other groups last summer after George Floyd died. Those protests last year were mostly peaceful, but there was some violence and looting involved. The cities preparing include Washington, D.C., and Mayor Muriel Bowser was joined at a news conference today by the city's Homeland Security Director, Chris Rodriguez.
Can you talk about the cities getting ready for the verdict in the Minneapolis trial?
I can tell you that the chief of police and the director of D.C. Homeland Security have been coordinating and preparing for several weeks, probably before the trial even began. We continue to hope that justice prevails in that trial. We also want to stay focused in our city on making sure that everyone is safe. So we have a request into the guard. Chief Conte has also put our police force on 12-hour shifts, which enhances our response capability. And that's been our posture for about a week.
And tell us a little bit more about your request for the National Guard.
I'll ask Chris to talk about that.
Yeah, thanks, Sam. So we put in a request to the National Guard a little over a week ago. We're requesting on behalf of the Metropolitan Police Department some assistance at traffic locations downtown, as well as some enhanced security for our metro stations in the downtown corridor, as well as a quick reaction force that can be deployed anywhere in the city in the event of large-scale protests. So again, all precautionary measures and all requests for support from the National Guard.
So they are going to be armed in some cases?
Well, I think that's important. It's important to note that they will not be armed. The only authority that can arm the National Guard is the president. And so we did not request any armed assistance for guard support.
But our request is pending.
Okay, so it hasn't been approved yet.
It has not.
Okay.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, along with Chris Rodriguez, director of D.C.'s Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency. Fox 5 in Washington reporting that D.C. police arrested three adults and one teenager in Saturday night's anti-police brutality protest as demonstrations broke out across the city. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signing a new law today to crack down on violent protesters, increasing criminal penalties for assault and defacing monuments and other public property during riots, also penalizing local governments that interfere with law enforcement attempts to contain riots, and provide a citizens' appeal process when cities and counties attempt to reduce police budgets. Here's Governor DeSantis.
We saw last summer some of the local governments were actually telling, not necessarily in Florida, but throughout the country, basically telling these folks to stand down, telling police to stand down while cities burnt, while businesses were burnt, while people were being harmed. That's a dereliction of duty. And so what our bill says that I'll sign into law today is that if you're derelicting your duty as a local government, if you tell law enforcement to stand down, then you're responsible for the damage that ensues. And if someone's been harmed or their property has been destroyed, then they can sue you for compensation. We also have penalties for people that commandeer highways, which we've saw in other parts of the country. Just think about it. You're driving home from work, and all of a sudden you have people out there shutting down a highway, and we worked hard to make sure that didn't happen in Florida. They start to do that, there needs to be swift penalties, and that's something that just cannot happen. We also saw around the country people toppling monuments of people like George Washington. This bill protects all monuments in Florida. You have no right to go in and take down monuments. We're not going to let the mob win the day with that. Bill also includes liability for mob intimidation. If you think about it, we saw images of people just sitting outside eating at a restaurant, and then you have this crazed mob circle around them and start screaming and really intimidating. I'm sorry, that's unacceptable. You're going to be held accountable. Mind your own business and leave people alone if they're not bothering you. And then finally, and probably maybe most importantly, if you riot, if you loot, if you harm others, particularly if you harm a law enforcement officer during one of these violent assemblies, you're going to jail. We're going to hold you accountable, and we're not going to end up like Portland, where this is just a daily occurrence where these people are doing this. They get arrested, they have their mugshot taken, and then they get put right back on the street to do it again.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in Polk County, Florida. He is a Republican, and Florida's Senate passed this bill last week, 23-17, only one Republican voting in opposition alongside Democrats. Attorney General Merrick Garland returning to Oklahoma City today to speak at a remembrance ceremony for the Oklahoma City bombing victims. This is the 26th anniversary. Garland was a young Department of Justice staffer who led the investigation in 1995. Today he warned that the same domestic extremism that led to the bombing that killed 168 people still exists today.
Although many years have passed, the terror perpetrated by people like Timothy McVeigh is still with us. Just last month, the FBI warned of the ongoing and heightened threat posed by domestic violent extremists. Those of us who were in Oklahoma in April 1995 do not need any warning. The hatred expressed by domestic violent extremists is the opposite of the Oklahoma standard. And this memorial is a monument to a community that will not allow hate and division to win. The Department of Justice is pouring its resources into stopping domestic violent extremists before they can attack, and prosecuting those who do, and battling the spread of the kind of hate that leads to tragedies like the one we mark today. We must all stand together against them for the safety of our communities and for the good of our country.
Attorney General Merrick Garland in Oklahoma City at the National Memorial and Museum on this anniversary of the 1995 bombing. Washington Post reporting the D.C. medical examiner has ruled that Capitol Police Officer Brian D. Sicknick suffered two strokes and died of natural causes the day after he took part in defending the Capitol during the attack January 6th. Last month, two men were arrested and charged with assaulting Sicknick and two other federal agents with a chemical irritant. But medical examiner Francisco J. Diaz telling the Washington Post that Sicknick's autopsy did not find any evidence that Sicknick suffered an allergic reaction to that chemical substance. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki went back and forth today with a Fox News reporter over President Biden's apparent turnaround about migrant policy. On Friday, the president signed an executive order retaining the Trump administration's 15,000 refugee cap before then committing to the 62,500 cap a couple of hours later. This came after President Biden received some criticism from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, including Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Here's part of the exchange at the White House briefing today.
Thank you, Jen. I'm still just a little bit confused about what changed between 1 p.m. on Friday and around 4:30 p.m. on Friday to go from we're not raising the refugee cap to we are raising it by May 15th. What changed in those 3.5 hours?
Well, I think as I just outlined, we never said we're not raising the refugee cap. In the morning we said, actually, and with the information we put out, was that once we reach 15,000, we will raise it. That was not accounted for in some of how people were, some of how people were digesting the information. And we wanted to be clear and send a message that we are a country that is welcoming refugees. Let's be clear, we are changing the policies of the last administration. We are changing the policy of not welcoming in people from Africa or people from the Middle East. That was the biggest factor preventing refugees from coming in during the last administration.
So are you saying this had nothing to do with the pushback from some Democrats on Capitol Hill, from Senator Dick Durbin to Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
I don't think you've articulated to me what our change in policy was. What was our change in policy from the morning to the afternoon?
The executive order from Friday morning said that the admission of up to 15,000 refugees remains justified, period. And yes, there was a caveat that you could raise that cap later, but I mean, it explicitly
says that. That's a pretty important caveat, that if we, when we reach 15,000, a subsequent presidential determination could be made. And again, the biggest challenge, because people weren't understanding what we were conveying to the public and weren't conveying what we were trying to project to countries around the world. And it's incumbent upon us to make sure there's an understanding of what the president's policies are, what he's trying to achieve, and what he feels morally is that we're going to welcome in refugees from around the world, change the policies from the past administration that where they were not welcoming in refugees from the Middle East and Africa. And that was important to him to take that first step and move it forward.
The line said the admission of up to 15,000 refugees remains justified. And can you understand how some people would interpret that?
Well, I think we all have a responsibility to provide all of the context. And so what I'm conveying is that we also included would also is reached that a subsequent presidential determination would be issued to increase admissions. And again, the battle is not the cap. The issue has been the limitations that have been put in place in the past. We overturned those and changed those. And it was always meant to be a first step.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. She was also asked today whether President Biden's reference to a crisis on the U.S.-Mexico border, he made that reference this weekend, means that it's now the official position of the White House that this is a crisis.
The president does not feel that children coming to our border seeking refuge from violence, economic hardships, and other dire circumstances is a crisis. He does feel that the crisis in Central America, the dire circumstances that many are fleeing from, that is a situation we need to spend our time, our effort on, and we need to address it if we're going to prevent more of an influx of migrants from coming in years to come.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Also today, the leaders of the two largest immigration enforcement agencies telling its officials to stop using terms regarded as offensive by immigrants, such as illegal alien and assimilation. Washington Post, the first to report the memos being issued by ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and CBP, Customs and Border Protection. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, in his third week of a hunger strike while behind bars, has reportedly been moved to a hospital in another prison after his doctor said he could be near death. U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recruiting former Obama administration official John Morton to be the department's first ever climate counselor, or climate czar, designed to help the country move away from fossil fuel energy in a financially sound way. Republican Congressman Steve Stivers is announcing he plans to retire from Congress May 16th to become CEO of the Ohio Chamber of Commerce. And Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett signing a book deal, according to a source telling Politico, her advance was $2 million. President Joe Biden talking about infrastructure spending today with 10 lawmakers, 5 senators, 5 House members, 6 from the Democratic caucus, 4 from the Republican side. And this group comprises former governors or mayors. The president says they understand firsthand the impact of federal dollar spending on infrastructure in local communities.
Thanks for coming in, guys. I want to thank my colleagues. They're still my colleagues. I'm more of a member of Congress than I've been here. But I'm glad you all came down. We're going to talk about our infrastructure package, and as I indicated earlier, I am prepared to compromise, prepared to see what we can do and what we can get together on. It's a big package, but there's a lot of needs, and so we're going to be talking about, number one, what should be included in the package. Obviously, I put a lot in the package. I think it all should be included, and how to pay for it. And there are two issues. I've noticed everybody's for infrastructure. The question is, who's going to pay for it? And that's what we're going to try to work out today, at least in this bipartisan group of members of the House and Senate. And a little secret here, full disclosure. I asked senators and congressmen who had either been governors or mayors, because they know what it's like to make things work, to make sure that you get things done and deal with infrastructure and the needs of your community. So that's why we're here. Hopefully we'll be able to reach some kind of consensus, at least in broad terms. So thank you all for coming in, and we'll be talking to you later. That's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about all of that right now.
Thank you. President Joe Biden in the White House Oval Office meeting with the group of members. Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, close ally to the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, writes Politico, suggested Sunday that he could be open to a smaller bipartisan infrastructure proposal. During a joint appearance on Fox News Sunday with Senator Chris Coons, Democrat, Cornyn told host Chris Wallace there is a core infrastructure bill that we might pass, so let's do it and leave the rest for another day in another fight. Cornyn's remarks came after Coons suggested last week that the bill be split into two parts, a bipartisan package that's around $800 billion and another package that would pass with just Democratic votes through the budget reconciliation process. That was all from Politico. Susan Ferriccio, Washington Examiner chief congressional correspondent, took a look at the chances of a bipartisan infrastructure bill passing Congress given all this.
Both parties are very, very far apart on what they want for infrastructure in terms of the size and scope of a bill and how to pay for it. In fact, they're so far apart, it seems impossible to me that they would ever cut any kind of deal, including the kind that Chris Coons is talking about, which does have some Republican support, but not much, where they would pass it in two parts. They do this core infrastructure bill that a lot of Republicans might find appealing, and pass that, depending on how they pay for it, which is a whole nother hurdle. And then you just do this part two, which would include this broader idea of what Democrats believe infrastructure to be. Healthcare, childcare, all kinds of things that are green energy initiatives, things that may not be traditionally thought of as infrastructure. So you have some Republicans who say, well, maybe I could do a two-part deal. It would look as though it would at least give my constituents the notion that I'm working to improve infrastructure and working with Democrats. But you also have Democrats who don't like that idea either. They want it all, as they say, one big bold package. They want it all together, because once you break things up, stuff can get pushed to the sidelines. You do the stuff that is bipartisan the most, and then maybe the second part gets left behind. Democrats are very wary of that. So given, I think the audio was really told the story here. They're very far apart. And on top of that, which is not included in what Cornyn and Coons and everyone was just saying, is they'd like to do this by the summer, because if they start moving this into an election year debate over infrastructure, it gets really politically risky for Democrats, because they would like to pay for this with some tax increases. Now, it's a corporate tax increase, state tax increase, things that may not affect people in certain income levels, but it's still a tax increase, and it could affect the economy and jobs. So Democrats want to get this through as quickly as they can, and to show the President Biden is achieving, this huge goal of an infrastructure reform package. But they're nowhere near able to do it. So what I predict will happen is they will just circumvent Republicans and try to get this thing through using that special budgetary tactic called reconciliation, which I know C-SPAN probably talks about quite a bit. It's just how you pass things with 51 votes. But it narrows what can be in the bill, because it has to address certain, has to have a budgetary impact and some other parameters that will make the bill less broad. I think that's ultimately where the party is going to go with this. They control the House and the Senate, the Democrats and the White House. They have this green light that's probably going to be temporary, the way our elections are going, and they'd like to get this done. So they don't have a lot of time to go back and forth with Republicans. Unless I see some big breakthrough, Biden is listening. He had a bipartisan meeting last week with Republicans. He's having one again this week. He's pledged to hold more meetings, and the Republicans say he's paying attention to them. But he would really have to take the lead on this and say, look, Democrats, we're going to agree to some of the things Republicans want. So far, it's just listening. And that's what happened with the COVID-19 package. He listened a lot to the Republicans, but ultimately they were not included in approving the final deal. It seems they're on that path right now, given the time parameters and the huge difference between the two parties of what exactly they want in this bill.
Susan Ferriccio covers Congress for The Washington Examiner, joining C-SPAN on Monday morning's Washington Journal. And a White House official telling CNN that the White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain will host leaders of the moderate House Democratic Blue Dog Coalition on Tuesday and key members of the New Democrat Coalition on Wednesday. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 123, NASDAQ down 137, S&P down 22. The Biden administration releasing about $8 billion in disaster relief funding for Puerto Rico and lifting restrictions that limited how that money could be spent in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in 2017. White House today launching a targeted media campaign raising awareness about vaccine eligibility and encouraging Americans to get vaccinated as states open up doses to all Americans over the age of 16. top Biden administration health officials taking part in about 30 local news interviews across the country. Andy Slavitt, White House senior advisor for COVID-19 response, said with 50% of U.S. adults having already received their first dose and 33% of adult Americans fully vaccinated, now's the time to get the others to step up.
If you still think it's too difficult to get your vaccine, here's what you need to know. The lack of supply, the shortage of locations, the confusing rules are all in the past. That cannot be said enough. Thanks to the aggressive action taken by many and the collaboration of so many people across the country, there are now thousands of more people ready to help you get vaccinated. There are now millions more vaccine doses available and waiting. And there are now more than 60,000 safe and convenient places for you to get your shot. Everyone who you've seen finally be able to safely hug a loved one, to visit each other without masks, to see old friends, that's an opportunity that's now within reach for you if you make your appointment. If you're 16 or over, it is your turn to get vaccinated, no matter where you live. And now there's a 9 out of 10 chance that you are located within 5 miles of your vaccine shot.
Andy Slavitt with the White House COVID-19 response team. So new information about how effective the vaccines are. The CDC director, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, says of the 84 million Americans with full vaccine protection, they have found fewer than 6,000 cases of COVID-19. That's a 0.007%. The state with the highest vaccination rate is New Hampshire, 71%, and the lowest is Tennessee, 40%. As the vaccinations continue, the question constantly being asked, when will things get back to some kind of normal? Dr. Walensky was joined by Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
Is it your medical opinion right now that, scientific opinion, that mask wearing will be necessary after the 100-day mark? Additionally, you know, is it advisable now for people who are vaccinated, fully vaccinated, to travel, or are you still recommending against it? And it's sort of a general sense of sort of when we can expect to see, what are the, you know, we've seen in Israel, they've begun to lift their outdoor mask mandates at 60-some-odd% vaccination rate. Is that a similar milestone that you're looking for when you change that that recommendation here in the U.S.? And any other sort of, you know, what milestones should the public expect as more people get vaccinated for when they can get back to normal?
So let me take a shot at the Israel thing. So I think we need to remember the slide that Dr. Walensky showed about the 7-day average of cases. That's between 60 and 70,000 cases a day. When you talk about the Israelis pulling back and getting to normal, their level of infection now is extremely low based on the fact that they have reached a level where they have now about 62% of them have received at least one dose. That's what we're aiming for. If you remember what I have said on multiple press conferences, that every time and every day you get more and more people vaccinated, sooner or later, hopefully sooner, that level of infection will get lower and lower. And when it does, it becomes easier and easier to get back to some degree of normality. But back to you, Dr. Walensky.
Yeah, I would just say, you know, this is an interplay between how many people are vaccinated and how much disease is out there. And while we're making extraordinary strides in the number of people vaccinated, we still have an extraordinary amount of disease out there. And so I think that interplay is one we really need to consider here. We know these vaccines work extraordinarily well as prevention interventions. However, they take some time to kick in, you know, somewhere in the 2 to 6 week mark. And so if we have a lot of circulating virus today, the vaccines will work, you know, in a month, but they may not work today. So we need to continue to keep the prevention measures up to prevent ongoing cases today.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky and Dr. Anthony Fauci at Monday's regular White House coronavirus briefing held virtually. Biden administration also announcing $150 million for community-based healthcare providers to increase their COVID response for underserved communities and vulnerable populations. NASA is still celebrating its achievement from overnight, flying an experimental helicopter named Ingenuity on Mars, the first powered flight by an aircraft on a planet other than Earth. The flight lasted 39 seconds. Ingenuity rose 10 feet. Here is NASA Acting Administrator Steve Jerusik.
Many, many challenges, including having to complete the helicopter development during a global pandemic. They had to get the size and weight of the helicopter down so they could achieve, you know, lift using rotary blades in a very thin atmosphere. And then, of course, they had another late challenge with having to do a software change and update and do that with a helicopter 180 million miles from Earth. So just an amazing job. This really is a Wright Brothers moment. It's the start of a whole new kind of planetary exploration, and we'll build on Ingenuity's success to see how we can deploy this capability on future Mars missions. We have this evolution of exploring planets in the solar system. First, we do a flyby, then we'll do an orbiter mission, then we'll do a lander mission, then we'll land a rover, and now we've added another evolutional capability there, flight on another planet.
NASA Acting Administrator Steve Jerusik at today's NASA briefing. He compared the Mars flight of the helicopter to Orville and Wilbur Wright, the brothers, and their historic airplane flight at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina in 1903. Ingenuity, the helicopter, carried a bit of wing fabric from Wright's plane. Thanks for being with us on Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere. Hope you have a very good evening.